When we open to chapter 11 in the new novel, The Gospel According to Danny, by David Hicks, we find that Danny had already burst into the bistro where he works, over an hour and a half after the first plane had crashed into the tower. And he was terrified, convinced that Leah, his wife, was at the site. Then Danny's phone rings. It's a strange number, and Hicks writes, "Her voice was hoarse, but it was her ukulele, his loving name for her. We're okay," she said. She spoke as if her lips were partially glued together. "We're okay." "Okay" is all Danny heard. "Alive." Johnny, the owner, patted Danny's shoulder, picked up his drink, and headed toward his office. His co-worker, Vanessa, remained on the bar stool next to him, her hands cathedraled to her mouth, her eyes wide and hopeful. "What? Where? I can only take a minute. Sorry. Oh, so many of us." She muttered something about the Putnam campus, and they had walked over to the towers and were heading lobby, north tower, bomb. But Danny could barely hear her over the cacophony of sounds, both muffled and sharp, filtering into the phone. She started to say something, only to cut herself off. And Danny thought she may have been talking to someone else, but then she said, I saw, and he understood. People jumping, bodies spattering on the cement. "It's okay," Danny shouted over the other voices. He walked away from Vanessa toward the coffee station. "You're okay," he said. "That's all I care. So Terrence is with you, right there with you?" "I have to go," she said. "I have to figure out. We need to get back. Oh, God, this is the worst. I love..." But she had hung up. Danny held the stupid little brick of a phone, staring at it. "Thank God in heaven," Vanessa said, her hand on her heart. Danny sat back. "Danny?" He heard Vanessa's voice, felt her touch on his arm. But he was swirling, his breath out of control, and he didn't know where he was for a while. When he returned, telling himself he was at the bistro, there's Johnny's office, there's Vanessa. He crossed his arms on the bar and rested his forehead on them. He was disgusted with himself. How loosely, how casually, how dishonorably had he held his bond with Leah, starting from the very beginning, that first summer after they'd met, when he hadn't bothered to call her after his trip to Puerto Rico, and then broke up with her without explanation after she had taken the bus all the way from Poughkeepsie to visit him. "We're too young to be in a committed relationship." Had he really said that to her? How cavalierly he had considered all their offs and ons in their 20s, thinking they had all the time in the world to figure things out. How ignorant of the slippery nature of seemingly solid things, and of the need, he knew now, but maybe too late, to constantly adjust, reassemble, strengthen, reshape, affirm. To be attentive, yes, attentive to love. Because at any moment, lacking such care, I mean, you just turn your head for a blinking second, such seemingly steadfast and impermeable entities, like giant steel towers, could, oh dear God, collapse like 110 concrete slabs of revenge. Chapter 11 from the new novel, The Gospel According to Danny, by David Hicks. If we consider the title, The Gospel According to Danny, we remember that one of the definitions of the word gospel is a set of principles or beliefs, a personal sense of the world to guide one's choices and acts in life. And in chapter 11, the scene gives us an experience of the way in which Danny wrestles with the wrenching experiences in his life and in the world at large, trying to make sense of what has happened and examining his own actions to learn how he's contributed to the occurrences, the ordeals that unfold in time as his life pushes on, shaping his personal gospel in a sense. David Hicks is author of the novel in stories, White Plains, and The Magic Ticket, an autobiographical children's book. He is an award-winning professor and recipient of two Fulbright scholarships. He is also the director of the Maslow Family Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Wilkes University. Dr. Hicks will take part in a number of book events this fall in Boston, Charlottesville, and Arlington, Virginia, Chicago, Rochester among them. This weekend, though, he will take part in the Milford Readers and Writers Festival here in Pike County, in conversation with Matthew Hinton, playwright and photographer from the faculty of Misericordia University. The program is titled How to Write a Book You Care About. David Hicks stopped in at the WVIA studios to tell us about his new novel and about one of his core beliefs, perhaps part of his own personal gospel, his belief in the power of stories and literature to help us endure trauma and trials in our lives. And he's discovered how strongly he holds that conviction in his autobiographical book for children, The Magic Ticket.
I think writing the book and reading the book to children and to adults has helped me to kind of frame it as not as bleak a story as I thought it was when I looked back on it. But after I wrote The Magic Ticket, which is about a little boy who loses his sister, his baby sister, 2-year-old, and then turns to books for solace because his house is quiet. His house is, you know, bereft. His parents are understandably just lost. And so I, as a little boy, without any books in the house, started reading at school and just devoured books, and then went to the library and continued to read as many books as I could. And it ended up, looking back, I didn't really realize this until I wrote the book, but it ended up shaping who I am. I became a reader. I became a professor of literature. I became a writer. And so the necessity or the escape I found in books ended up being a kind of sanctuary and a salvation of sorts. And this is really, I just can't wrap my head about like how an accident or an incident that nobody asked for ends up shaping a person. You know, like, you know, I am who I am because of what happened to me. And I didn't want it. I didn't ask for it. But I like how that happened. And I think my sister would love that too, because I used to read to her after she died. I used to just imagine her in the crib or in the bed listening to me read as I did when she was a baby. And it brings me great solace. It's ended up being a lifting of a heaviness that was there, a kind of lightness now, where I have a kind of a new relationship with her, and certainly a new appreciation for books, even though I didn't really need to learn that. But I did, to be honest, as a literature professor and a director of an MFA program, I've read other people's books a lot, and required books, required reading. And now I'm determined to read for joy again, the way I did when I was young. I just haven't. I've been reading, like, if I have to teach something, I read it. If I have students who are writing their theses, which are, you know, full manuscripts, I read, or as best I can, I skim. You know, I spend a lot of time reading books that I'm required to read. But the origin of that was that I loved reading. And so I really want to get back to that.
And does that, when you come to do something like the Gospel According to Danny, when you use the word shape, shape your impulse? You'd love it if somebody read this and maybe had that kind of experience?
Yeah, that I think if there's a reason why I write, it's that. It's to connect with anybody who's been through difficulty and has made mistakes and has had other people impact them with their infidelities or their mistakes, and sort of take one hit after another and try to reshape themselves. That's what this book does. That's what this book is about. A character like me in some ways, but more fictional than usual, who really wants to work hard and achieve the American dream, but just gets hit with one thing after another, either politically or personally. And we have to see if he can stand the test of all these hits or if he can succumb to them. And if you live long enough, that's what happens, right? I mean, you just get hit with stuff. And so that's what I'm trying to convey in the book.
Danny is a character who is living at a particular time in this country. So when you mention the impact of external political events on the story, many of us recognize the time and the places in that regard.
Yeah, and that gets to one of the impulses for writing the book. I wanted to write, I thought at the time of the Bush-Gore election in 2000, it was right after Columbine was 99 or 2000, and then the Bush-Gore election, and then 9/11, right? The year after, 2001. So it was a big time in our country, and that election really didn't begin the divide. Like, it didn't begin what we're experiencing now, which is like two really diametrically opposed citizens, right? And two different parties that seem to hate each other. But it did certainly accelerate that with the kind of partisan anger and dealings, backroom dealings at the time. And it did shape the future of the country. In retrospect, a lot of people at the time were saying that Bush and Gore were sort of moderates and they're very similar. I remember this very well, but I also remember thinking, no, one of them really wants to save the world. In fact, he wrote a book about it. And the other one is kind of a corporate guy, you know, like he's going to help people make money and help his rich friends. And that's what happened. Like, it, whatever you feel about whatever political party you're on, that election really split us up. And then it just got worse and worse the more that happened, because the book ends, you know, the book goes through the 2000s and the 2010s with some school shootings and some, you know, some of that stuff and the racial discrimination and trying to put things fairly. And it ends with the Trump nomination. And during that time, during those 15 years, that's what's happened. We've become so divided. And yet, like, in person, such kindness and such, you know, like, we get along really well. We help each other. Like, there's everyday people are, I think, really nice. But politically and online, we've gotten really mean. And that sort of happened from 2000 to 2015. It certainly started way back in the beginning, but it's sort of accelerated during this time. And Danny, as someone who's trying to make money, trying to make a living, trying to support his family during this time, realizes that even though he wants the American dream, it's not the same America as his father worked in. And it's not a place where you could work really hard and support your family. It's no longer that place. So he doesn't ever realize that, but that's what we're dealing with when he sort of struggles to work harder and harder to try to support his family. Meanwhile, he forgets the most important thing, which is time and human connection between himself and his kids. So it's very much a story of its time, even though it's very much a story about this one guy named Danny.
And you navigated that splendidly. I don't think it's imbalanced in any way.
Thanks. That's kind of tricky, because it could have been it was actually the first draft, a very agenda-driven book, you know, and it took over the story. And I had to keep reminding myself, this is a story about Danny. This is a human story of a guy who's a moderate, like he wants He wants the old Republican Party. He's a Republican. He wants the party that can, you know, write bills with Democrats and tax the rich a little higher than, you know, the way Reagan did, and gun control the way Reagan did, you know, that kind of thing. And he finds himself without a party after a while, because it's just the Tea Party at first, and then MAGA Republicans kind of take over.
Is the use of dates, specific dates, not just because Columbine took place or 9/11 took place on these dates, but the use of dates to delineate certain parts of the story, does that help us chart societal political development?
Yeah, if you're writing a book with this scope, it's 15 years. It's tough. The book I'm writing now is 3 days, so it's really easy. It's just like, it's 7 o'clock on Thursday, and you know where we are. But this one, 15 years, I spent a lot of time and long prose in the first third, and then shorter chapters, and then I go year by year, one episode per year, and then I go really, really tight on the ending, just to reflect the passage of time, but also the kind of crumbling, fragmenting of the country at the time and of Danny's life. But I have to put in markers for that so people know where we are. Oh, if it's 2010, then he's 40 now. He's not 30 anymore. And if it's, if I give cultural references, song titles, or political incidents, the certain events that we mark our lives by, because we know what happened. We know where we were at 9/11. I know where I was during the Sandy Hook shootings. These kinds of things are cultural markers, and we then kind of know what year we're in, where we are in Danny's development, and where we were as a country.
When you finish a project, whether it be the book or the Magic Ticket or what you've been writing, is that it? You go, I'm done.
No.
Because some writers say, oh no, that was last year. I'm on to something else. Or will this always stay with you?
Oh, it will always stay with me. And I'll always, even when I'm reading it now, I'm on this little book tour. And as I'm giving readings, I'm making corrections. I'm finding a typo, or I'm thinking, I really didn't need that last paragraph. And I think that's always going to be case. It's certainly true with White Plains. I look back on that and think of revisions I could make. But the story, the feeling of the story, I'm really proud of it. It was very hard to write. I've never written anything this big or this political. My first two books were just, very microscopic looks at individuals without any kind of cultural settings or anything like that. This one is just chock full of them. And it was a sort of a sprawling mess, the first draft. And I just, over 10 years, just kind of whittled it down to its essential story. And now when I'm getting reviews that are really good, and I'm getting feedback from people who just they're calling it a page turner. And I've never written a page turner, Erica. I don't know how to write a page turner, but I did. Like, they're turning the page. So it has a plot, it moves, and not as much as White Plains. It doesn't take as long to tell the story, but it moves essentially quickly because I'm covering all this time period. So every scene, something better happen or else it gets thrown out. So yeah, I'm very proud of it.
And you went off to a retreat to write it, did you? Or you went off to a cabin that your wife had?
Oh yeah, yeah. This is the origin of it. I brought 3 legal pads to a cabin that my wife reserved for me. This is when we were in Colorado and in Evergreen. And all I did was from dawn to midnight, I just wrote it out. A very big book and several legal pads. And then spent the next 10 years revising it.
I guess it was today, there was a story about the American dream and who has it and who doesn't and who's never going to get it and those sorts of things. Okay, so that's there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the awful shooting in Minnesota, another school shooting. And you give us a remarkable sense of what it might be like to be a parent of a child.
Yeah, there's a passage in there where Danny wonders if this is in 2012 or something like that, or 14. Danny wonders if in the future everyone's going to be homeschooled and kids are going to wear bulletproof vests and, that kind of thing, and be antisocial and need a lot of coaching on making friends and all that, because, when is this going to end, right? And then I just heard a few days ago that there are backpacks, bulletproof backpacks, that parents are giving their kids. to take the school with them. And that seems to me like, yep, that's where we're headed. And it's horrible. And in contrast, I spent, as you know, I was on a Fulbright scholarship in Prague, and my apartment was across the street from a school. And those kids, there are no drills. They all go outside every day in the snow or rain or sunshine and wear brightly colored yellow vests. And they play is a very important part of their school. There are no school shootings. It's not even a worry. They're just going to school and being kids. And it makes me really sad for our kids and our parents. Like, there's no right answer. Like, you don't know what to say to your kid when they say, is it going to be me? Like, is this going to be at my school? Well, no, I'm sure it won't be. But in the back of your mind, there's this kind of horror that, yeah, it could be. So I don't know what the answer is, but I know that in other countries, they've outlawed AK-40s or 47s. They've outlawed any semi-automatic or automatic weapons. You need to get interviewed and permission to get a gun. Like, you need to be responsible. And that has helped. That's helped to curb or eliminate mass shootings. And we're just not doing that here because we're sticking with this thinking that it's not guns. And it isn't, but it is. Anything we could do to help should be done to save our children and help them to grow up in a world where they don't have to worry about that. All our kids now go through drills, active shooter drills. Every kid, little kids. Terrible. There's no place safe.
This is a story with so many layers and so many threads that you've been able to weave together. And parenthood is certainly one of them, not just parents of children who are vulnerable to school shootings, but what about the sense of Danny coming to terms with what it means to be a parent and his wife, Leah?
Yeah, I think it's not true of me because I divorced my kid's mother when they were little and I lost them for a while. And I learned to just cling to and treasure desperately every minute I have with them. And my daughter just visited me, a surprise from Chicago, a few days ago. And I couldn't keep myself from crying, or just, I couldn't believe it, that she's 32 years old and she drove down to surprise me in a coffee shop. It was really sweet. My wife and she conspired, but I treasure her and I tell her all the time, and my son. But if you are a parent, you know, not a divorced parent, if you're a parent of new kids, newborns or children, there's a tendency to get so involved in the day-to-day stuff. You're just making do. You're just getting breakfast ready and lunch and getting on the bus or to school, and you're cleaning up after them. It's so hard, even with one, to say nothing of six or seven. And there is this sort of natural tendency in any relationship to sort of take things for granted because, you know, you're just getting through your days, including a marriage, especially when you have kids. And so Danny is like that in the beginning. And then when it all kind of unravels and he loses his identity as a father in different ways, he sort of has to rethink what it means to be a father. And it's not like on the page, like Danny thought about what it meant to be a father, right? But he's coping, he's trying to get by, but he does have to rethink what it means to have this kid, you know, and be her father, and what that means for his identity and his values and how he spends his time. That emerged as the most important part of this book, and I didn't expect it. I thought it was about the marriage. But I intuitively, when I first wrote the book, the first draft was introduced by his daughter. Danny has died. This isn't true in the book that exists now. And she has found his papers and his journals, and she's gone online and found his online stuff. And it's called The Gospel According to Danny because his blog post was called, his name is Danny Gospel, spelled the German way. But his blog post was The Gospel According to Danny. And that was the original book, The Findings of His Daughter. And in the reading of his work, the daughter develops a new relationship with him. Now I flipped it. Now it's Danny's story, and the daughter is in his story, and they develop a new relationship through what happens to them, which we're not going to give away.
No. And I'm interested in the friendship, his best bud.
Max and Danny are best friends, and Max is a muscular liberal. He ends up working for Amnesty International. He's a lawyer. And Danny is a moderate Republican. And so I get some of the political stuff out through their dialogue, but also it's kind of a model for how I think we should be. Like, you know, just you can disagree, but still love each other and find common ground, which just doesn't seem to be the case now. And I'm still marveling at it. I'm hoping it comes back someday, but it's so hard with social media algorithms giving you exactly what you want to hear about your point of view and giving the other side exactly what they want to hear. It's so hard for that common ground discussion to happen because that usually happens in person. It usually doesn't happen online. And we've kind of lost that. Most of our social exchanges are online now, especially for young people. So I think through Danny and Max, I don't think it's evident that this is an agenda of sorts, but it's just their friendship based on my friendship with one of my friends and kind of an amalgam of two friends. But I love how close they are and how goofy they are with each other, because there is humor in this book. But I also like how they drift apart because of the times kind of pulling them apart, but how ultimately they're still there for each other at the end.
The story moves along, and it does, and it has to. We spend a lot of time in cars. Max and Danny are in the car, and yeah. Is that a sign of the times? We're going up the Taconic, and we're coming back down.
Yeah, that's from me, because I moved to Colorado 27 years ago from here. I was in Scranton in the late 90s, and Colorado is a big state, and there's a lot of driving. So anytime the kids were with me, usually for the summers, we'd go on road trips. Also, when I come back to New York, they lived upstate when they were young, so I would drive them to my parents in near the Bronx in Westchester County, and that's a five-hour drive. So a lot of my interactions with the kids was me at the wheel and them in the back seat causing trouble, or when they got big enough, you know, shotgun, whoever got shotgun. So a lot of my life has been spent and never been in an accident. Never been in an accident.
Well, you write them well.
But yeah, that's why there's so much about cars in there.
But it also seems to have some sense of propulsion. And
yes, it's movement. It's going somewhere and trying not to get in an accident on the way. It's a metaphor. And for America, too, because we drive like crazy, like compared to other countries. We don't just go out the front door and walk to the market to get our food. Like, we're always driving. So, and it's a big country. So it is a metaphor for the movement in Danny's life and most of our lives, very fast paced, very anxious. The work is very anxiety producing. He's a waiter at a busy restaurant. And also the way we communicate in a kind of fleeting temporal way.
And he has some Puerto Rican mm-hmm. heritage.
Yeah, I want to make him, I sort of maybe tried too hard to make him a kind of amalgam of different. So his mom's Puerto Rican, his dad's sort of German, English. His biological great-grandfather is an African man, a black African man from Northern Africa. And Leah is Jewish, and she ends up with a black man who's half Korean. And so at one point the kids say, "What are we?" You know, I know we're Latina, but not really. And Danny doesn't really know who he is. All their names, Danny's real name is Dante. And Miggy, his brother, is Miguel, and his sister Josie is actually Josefina. So they're all like Americanized in a way and asked to be American. But at the same time, there's this heritage tugging at them that they ignore because they're passing as white. They are white. They're raised white. But there is this pull on, and almost all of us, I would say, all of us are European descent, that there's this pull of another place that we ignore at our peril, and it gets ignored all the time, especially with the anti-immigration stuff by a nation of immigrants who just conveniently ignore their own immigrant status or grandparents' immigrant status for the new group that now has to be kicked out because they were here second or third. My mom is from Italy. It's tugging at me a lot because my dear aunt, her sister, just died yesterday. So that all of them are there. My mother's family, five siblings, 30 or so cousins of mine, their kids, they're all there. And I grew up, my name is David Hicks. There's no Italian in it, but I am half full Italian. And my American side is actually just a mess of all kinds of stuff, English, Dutch, who knows? It goes back to the second boat after the Mayflower. So I'm very sure of my Italian heritage and my Italian identity, and I love it there. I feel home there. And I'm not sure about my American side, weirdly. Most people, it's the opposite. But no matter what it is, Danny's dad calls him a half-breed, and he says that we're all mutts, after all. We are all mutts, and so I'm trying to make Danny a kind of representative and still keep it real, like still keep it close to what I am, so it's authentic. But I want to make him a representative of most America, like an everyman in America. He's struggling with his own identity, and he's just trying to do what everybody tries to do. He's trying to make money and make a good living.
When you speak about metaphors and perhaps larger contexts, we've talked about the society and the politics. But what about the mountain, and what about the angels?
Yeah, this is all sort of unconscious. I don't really think about this part anyway. But I've always been aware. Well, no, I haven't always been aware. When I was an adult, I became aware that we are made of the same stuff as stars, right? Which just blows me away. I just pause for that because I still can't get used to it. But I've noticed that we get so steeped in our own stuff as Americans. We just get so focused on and proud of being Americans, even though our births were accidental. It's like being proud of a sports team just because your dad, you know, you just were born here. We're lucky. It's a good place, but there is a bigger world and we're connected to that world. And I think we've lost that connection with nature and with the universe, both in our human sense of, you know, putting national parks over here and living in this corporate area or the suburbs. So in that sense, we've lost our connection with nature, unless we go for hikes and all that stuff, but that's just temporary. And in the larger sense, we've lost our connection with the universe by being so focused and so jingoistic and nationalistic about America, and instead of understanding that what happens to humans, like the kids in Gaza, is happening to all of us. Like, it's happening to us. It's humans. And so we just lose it. And so Danny, who's steeped in American culture and American life and in his own kind of malleable and constantly changing beliefs, is constantly yearning for some connection for the bigger picture. And he finds it finally in Wyoming. And he also tries to pray. He has no religion. And he finds this kind of connection in this. This is a real story in Cookeville, Wyoming. There was a shooting at a school. And the kids and their parents said that they saw angels in the room protecting the kids, and they swear by it. And so when I heard about that, I thought, that's ridiculous, but they swear by it. And so Danny goes, he has this wandering toward the end where he goes all over the country, and he's sort of drawn to the West and drawn to the wildness of the West. And it's a place that's dear to me because I lived out there, and I spent time in Wyoming too, and Montana, and it's just breathtakingly beautiful, but there's also a kind of anger and meanness there, which is worthy of exploring. But he goes there and he finds this kind of connection with the mountain and with the land and with the moon and the sun and the planets and with these people who saw angels. And he starts to see angels and he starts to pray, and I'm putting air quotes on because he finds something in him that's yearning for something else, right? Something bigger than he is. And that's kind of the culmination of all these little references we get throughout the book of the stars or constellations or things like that. Because he has, according to a girl in Puerto Rico, she has a constellation on her cheek, the Pleiades, and he has a kind of stamp of an African country on his neck. He has a birthmark on his neck, kind of the origin of all things and then the universe, embedded and embodied in these two characters as a kind of metaphor for how we probably want to live.
Tell me what you generally read for the book tour, and would you like to read something for us?
Sure. I've been reading all over, just sort of trying to capture scenes, but I can read a short scene at the beach after his wife, Leah, she's pregnant with their second child, and their first is 2 years old. And she's had a kind of flirtation with another man, but Danny wants to make it work. And he's, you know, hanging in there. And so they go after a sort of a tumultuous day, and just before the baby's born, we get a scene at Sherwood Island, which is a little beach in Connecticut that I've been to a few times. So it's at Sherwood Island, a little beach in Connecticut. This is chapter 22. Sherwood Island, a quiet beach, especially on a weekday. Seagulls, lapping water, faint music. Nothing like Jones Beach, their planned destination. But there was still the ocean, really the Long Island Sound, the sand under all the pebbles and shells, and it was closer, 40 minutes versus an hour 45, and safer. You think differently when you have a child. It had been Danny's idea, but still, the prospect of spending the day at the beach always triggered in him simultaneously an outward joy and an inward, atavistic reckoning. He yearned for the ocean on both an unconscious and cellular level. His mother's side of the family was surrounded by the sea, not only in Puerto Rico, but farther back from Valencia, Spain, and the North African coast. Here at Sherwood, the Atlantic harmlessly settled into the sound, nothing scary about it, and Danny felt instantly calmed by the presence of the sea. Home. But he also found himself looking out, way out, trying to determine the potential for that rogue wave, the quake-triggered tsunami that would come without warning and kill everyone within 5 miles of the shoreline. What if today's the day? He couldn't possibly transport his wife and daughter to higher ground in time. Around here, there was no higher ground. He thought of his brother, way out there beyond the opposite shores of this ocean. Would the inevitable apocalypse come in a frenzied fury by way of the war to end all wars, this time for real, or in a nightmarish convoy of natural disasters? Or had it already crept in and would continue to creep, completely human-caused, our freshwater drained, the atmosphere in irreversible disrepair, the earth either baked of its nutrients or on fire, our food and water poisoned, the forests scalped of their oxygen-providing trees. Leah had given him Al Gore's book a while back, and he had recently made the mistake of reading it. Now his wife and daughter were staring at him expectantly, so he put the bag down and held up the beach umbrella. Time to do his job. As Leah bent over, her black and white bathing suit tight around her pooched abdomen, to pull out the blanket and Cassandra's sun hat, Danny put up the umbrella the way his gran tio Horatio had taught him in Culebra, in imitation of the soldiers planting the flag at Iwo Jima, rotating it hard into the sand. He used his feet to push sand around the base of the pole, while Leah spread sunblock on their daughter's shoulders as she tried to squirm away toward the shore. This is life, he thought, right here. You never know what's coming, but you have to live as if it isn't going to come at you. Yes, a tsunami could very well be in the offing. Yes, a nuclear bomb could drop on Manhattan, but the odds were infinitesimal in both cases. You had to scrape that image from your mind and instead drop down on the pebbly sand to help your daughter make a castle that would end up looking like a giant wart. That was the answer. The answer was to acknowledge your brother was back in Iraq because the Army had decided a sharpshooter who might be gay was better than no sharpshooter at all. To acknowledge your wife could miscarry the child in her womb as she had the first. And to recognize at any moment you could die suddenly of a heart attack or terrorist attack or cancer attack, or your wife could die in childbirth, or your 2-year-old daughter could die in her sleep, but still get up in the middle of making the castle, give your wife a kiss while she's on her phone, tell her how sexy she looks, even though at that very moment she may have been texting her friend, Terrence, and go back and stand vigil over your daughter, letting your shadow protect her from the sun, before dropping back down and helping her with her next project, which was to bury her toy dinosaurs deep into the earth in an apparent replication of the last great species extinction. Then, gently, tell her to close her eyes as you use her red bucket to pour seawater over her head. Let me rinse the sand from your hair, darling. And lean in close to note the single drop lingering on her eyelashes and the smile beginning to form on her lips.
David Hicks, reading from his new novel, The Gospel According to Danny. David Hicks is author of the novel in stories, White Plains, and The Magic Ticket, an autobiographical children's book. He is an award-winning professor and recipient of 2 Fulbright scholarships. He is also the director of the Maslow Family Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Wilkes University. And he was speaking with us about this new novel that has just been issued by Vine Leaves Press. Dr. Hicks will be part of this weekend's Milford Readers and Writers Festival in Milford, Pennsylvania. His program will take place on Sunday, the 14th, at 12:30 in the afternoon, and it's a conversation with Matthew Hinton, who is a playwright and photographer and member of the faculty at Misericordia University. The program is titled How to Write a Book You Care About. That's this Sunday, September 14th, at 12:30 in the afternoon, as part of the Milford Readers and Writers Festival. The festival opens on Friday, tomorrow, and will run through Sunday. And if you need more information, milfordreadersandwriters.com. In the offing, Dr. Hicks will read in October in Binghamton at Atomic Tom's Pub. He'll also be at the Moravian Academy in Bethlehem on Green Pond Road with a reading. He'll be on November 1st, Page to Stage, Scranton at the Diva Theater, and he will read from the Gospel According to Danny. In November as well, Word to Word in Wilkes-Barre, November 8th, he'll read at 7 o'clock with two of his favorite writers. The 10th, he'll be at the Albright Memorial Library in Scranton on Vine Street. Just some of the places he'll read. He'll be in Boston and Philadelphia and Rochester, Chicago. And if you need more information about David Hicks and his books and his events, it's david-hicks.com. David-hicks.com, H-I-C-K-S.